bring extraordinary news and the world's most remarkable personalities. Welcome back to another hour of the Jeff Rentz Program, live, coast to coast, and worldwide on the Internet. And now, here's Jeff.
All right, let's get rolling. Clifford Carnicom is back for a chemtrail update, and I continue to get email from all around the country of people who are complaining. Although I must say, in the last month, well, 3-4 weeks, Clifford, the amount of email has fallen away, probably because of so much cloud cover, of course, in the middle of winter and storm activity. But that doesn't mean the activity above the clouds is not continuing. How is it seeming to you?
Good evening, Jeff, and thank you again for the opportunity to be here. And,
sure.
I would say the circumstances in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in this desert region, have not really changed in any kind of beneficial way. And in fact, we've had several days where the activity has been very extensive and overt and frequent.
Yeah. Clifford Carnicom's website, and if you're saying, what's he saying? Carnicom, Carnicom, Carnicom.com. It is the premier chemtrail website. When you open on Carnicom.com, look in the upper right corner, chemtrail crimes and cover-up documented. I do get reports, Clifford, from people from time to time who say, gee whiz, the storm separated or there was a break in the weather, and guess what we saw up above? Same old thing.
Right, and one of the patterns that does seem to be apparent to many observers is the increased activity preceding storm fronts. So there are questions that can be raised in terms of the intent for descent of the material in combination with storm fronts.
For those of you who don't know the name Clifford Carnicom, he has been at the forefront of independent chemtrail research and doing a magnificent job of pulling together material from all over the world and especially the United States and doing his own scientific applications. He is a scientist, a lay scientist, if you will, and he has really achieved some remarkable things. The website continues to be a remarkable thing to visit for anybody who is interested in this issue. I'm sure your guest list, Clifford, also maintains its unusual numbers of, shall we say, government intelligence visitors?
It certainly does continue, and one of the consistent visitors would be what's called NIPR. This is one that I've noticed quite a bit, and it appears to be sort of a blanket organization for combining basically the control of Internet traffic through the Defense Department.
NIPR, I don't know that one.
Yes,
that's a new one
for the, this is the Department of Defense Network Operations.
Hmm.
And apparently the function of the organization is to funnel all traffic related to, let's say, defense monitoring through a central gateway in order to increase or improve security, as well as I would also assume in some way anonymize the process of monitoring.
Right. Well, it certainly does that, apparently, at least to some degree. How many years have you been researching this now, Clifford?
Well, we're into the third year now, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Over 2 years now.
Yeah. I would say, on balance, we are making progress. I hope you would concur with that. I don't know how close we are to finding out what the hell is going on, to put it in the vernacular.
Yeah, I would say we are definitely making progress, Jeff. My main concern centers around the motivation level and activity level of the citizens of this country once they have the information that gives them a proper case for seeking an investigation.
Quite, or even hassling their local news authorities.
Right, and I think this is something each one of us needs to ask. It's not just a question of seeking information. It's using that information with the intent of producing a result and fulfilling the foundations of this country steeped in the Constitution and certain basic human rights which exceed any of those of any particular government.
Right, right. All right, you've got a little outline of things you want to go ahead and cover tonight, which we'll certainly follow. One of the most, I think, important issues on the website, though, is your top, well, in fact, the top two items up there, biological operations confirmed and HEPA biologicals confirmed. So we'll just take the list as you've put it together, because I know you've got a nice agenda and we usually work right through it. So go ahead with, if you want to take number one, we'll do that. That's cloud-ion relationships.
Sure, Jeff. I hope you were able to get the later list that I sent you a little bit longer than the first short one I sent you.
Just got it a little while ago.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And do we have an hour tonight?
We have 2 hours.
Oh, okay, so there's no rush at all. I'm planning for an hour to cover this material, and maybe we can elaborate or raise questions after the material is covered.
Sure.
The first thing I'd like to do is sort of tie in with some earlier discussion we had many interviews ago. And the topic goes back to this question of clouds forming under conditions of extremely low relative humidity.
Right.
Now, we've observed that, and there have been two rationales that have been put forth as to how we can have a purported cloud formation occurring under such conditions of low relative humidity when conventionally, meteorologically speaking, it's not possible. And those two rationales which have been put forth thus far are the introduction of a very small particle. If you remember, some time ago I brought up a study done at the Colorado State University basically modeling the cirrus cloud formation process, and one of the conclusions of that study that can be made is that the smaller the particle that is in the atmosphere,
mm-hmm.
The greater the rate of nucleation or cloud formation.
All right.
That was quite a while ago, and it is interesting to see how some of these things tie together. But that's one rationale as to how you could interfere or modify that process, is by introducing a very small particle. A second rationale that has emerged over time is the introduction of a salt material,
mm-hmm.
A hygroscopic or a water-loving molecule or substance is a reasonable explanation as to how you can have a cloud formation process begin at lower relative humidities, and in fact, that is the explanation as to why a haze or cloud formations can occur along the coast where you have salt in the air.
Sure.
And allowing formations at lower relative humidity. What I'd like to do tonight is add a third rationale to that list. And the combination of these is actually very fitting. In other words, it's very reasonable when you consider this combination as explaining what it is we're seeing. We have number one. We have number two. The third one that I'd like to mention, and I'll sort of tie into the website as we go along, and I realize some folks don't have access to this, but there is a page that's been put up there recently called Ionization Clouds Relationship. And basically, the additional information that we can now consider and add to that scenario described thus far,
mm-hmm.
is that ions themselves serve to collect moisture. That is important in terms of work that has been established regarding particulate matter, which we talked about last time and which mm-hmm. we can elaborate on tonight also.
Positive ions or negative ions, does it matter?
I don't know that. My statement thus far says ions. However, apparently most particulate matter is apparently positively charged, from what I can gather.
Mm-hmm.
But the statement is that moisture tends to concentrate around ions, and that this is a probable explanation for formation of clouds in the sky. And this comes from a chemistry textbook by a fellow named Massetta in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is important, that if you consider these three things together, they are actually very, very appropriate and very fitting for that which we see.
Right.
If you consider the introduction of a very small particle, a salt particle, especially a metallic salt particle, as well as the state of being an ion or a charged particle, this combination is basically the perfect combination to try and to explain basically that aberration from cloud formation that we have been witnessing for over the last 2 years.
The non-dissipating contrail. Now we call it, of course, chemtrail, but that that pulls in all three and they fit. I see what you're saying.
Right. So I'd like, you know, people to have that combined picture because we truthfully do want an explanation for what it is we're seeing. And this, to me, is a very reasonable combination of conditions, all of which tie together. And it's always important to have all of the data work together and tie together. If something doesn't work, we have to explain that. But every one of these is very consistent in terms of both explaining what we're seeing as well as consistent with any physical and or observational evidence that is available to us.
No rationalization needed at all. They just do seem to tumble right together.
The next topic is somewhat related, and this topic now has to do with the energy of ionization. And the reason that this topic comes up is that through the evening, I do hope that the audience will not forget or lose track of the evidence that is now existing for this particular matter. That's extremely important, and it's not to be forgotten in light of the new information, which is also coming.
All right, we're going to tie it together as we move forward with our interview, our conversation tonight with Clifford Carnicom, our foremost researcher into chemtrails on the net, carnicom.com. carnicom.com. Be right back. I'm Jeff Rentz. Glad you're here. Stay tuned. We'll continue. Okay, and welcome back. And for those of you new again to this chemtrail issue, carnicom.com, the website, when you pull that first page up, just take a look at some of the images there. And the top stories, of course, start reading and you'll catch on real fast. Okay, Clifford.
Thank you, Jeff. As the evening progresses, there will be two main themes that will emerge, which by the best evidence that I've been able to collect and by my research, there are two themes that arise from the aerosol operations that we're speaking of. The first will be an electromagnetic aspect, and the second will be biological. The conversation at this point is still restricted to the electromagnetic portion, and the conversation we had previously laid the foundation for that, and I do need to emphasize the particulate matter which was found and at the levels that it's found and the behavior of that material.
Very, very small particulates. Of course, you're alluding back to our conversations about Dr. Bernard Eastland's patents and other things that appear to be related to this kind of potential. Go ahead.
That's right, and we had a pretty thorough discussion last time on that, but I do hope that the audience will not let that subject lag because it is one of the two main points of research that calls for activity and help.
Got it.
Thus far. And what I'd like, and really the issue here arises from the behavior of that material. Very few people have had the opportunity to see that video. which is taken, and actually can be taken any time. I've taken 4 or 5 times now. It can be taken at any time. The behavior of this material is most remarkable because of its apparent charged behavior.
Right.
The motion of the material indicates it's electrically charged, and that is important to explain, because if you have something up there that indicates that it has a source of energy or is electrically charged, again, to be consistent, you have to have a source of energy.
Yeah, is it being charged or is it carrying its own charge? Then it would appear that it's being charged somehow.
You have to make sense of that. And so that is what I have attempted to do, is look at the question of, if you were to have a metallic salt material in the atmosphere in abundance, which is now recordable on film, what would it take to energize that material, and where would the energy come from? And there is a process called photoionization that I've looked into over the last month or so.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the experimentation in physics shows us and tells us that light alone is sufficient to energize some materials.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that it's not all materials, it's some materials. So again, this is where we have to get specific. There is a certain minimum amount of energy that is required. It's a quantity. It's tabulated. It's within the periodic table information that tells you how much energy does it take to ionize or charge a particular element. And what I have done is consider groups 1 and groups 2 of the periodic table, since they have always been the strongest candidates, the most sensible candidates, to tie in with the hypothesis and postulates involving metallic salts and the relative humidity and the pH studies that we've talked about, solubility. Those two columns in the periodic table, the first one, which are called the alkalis and earth alkalis, have always been the strongest candidates and remain so. Of those two groups, certain elements have had a higher level of interest by myself than others, especially barium and magnesium. What I have done is I have looked at each of those elements, and I have researched and acquired that information that tells us how much energy is required to ionize or charge these materials, and find out which ones make sense and which ones do not make sense in terms of what we are seeing.
Okay.
And the results are rather interesting. This is all listed up on the website also. This will be listed under a link that will say ionization apparent, or on the front page it would say ionization apparent,
right,
is the link for this page that I speak of. And within that page there is a tabular listing of the elements along with this energy that's required.
Got it.
And the findings are this. It's really quite interesting. Let's take 3 elements as an example. You can take others, and you can look at the numbers and see how they would all relate. But here's 3 interesting examples.
All right, we're coming up on a break, so go ahead and let's put the 3 elements out there. Then we'll pause, come back, and reset this and do it right on through.
Okay, the elements to be considered right now would be the element of barium, the element of magnesium, and the element of aluminum, all of which have assumed, let's say, a role of interest in the analysis that's been taken thus far.
All right, they have caught the attention of Clifford Carnicom. And we'll be right back and hope your attention stays right with us as we roll along on this Tuesday night.
Jeff Rentz will be right back following these messages on the Talk Radio Network.
Email coming in already. Here's one, Clifford, a quick one from a friend in Portland, Oregon. Dear Jeff, we had two absolutely beautiful sunny blue sky days here yesterday and today. I watch the sky every day and take notes. No silvery haze obfuscating the moon and stars at night either. This hasn't happened since last year when a local talk show host announced that the subject the following day would be on chemtrails. That very day, the local CBS News affiliate rushed to the radio studio and did a hit piece that night on her and her program. The chemtrails, however, then stopped for the next 3 to 4 weeks. That's from RS in Portland.
Yes, and unfortunately, the report for Santa Fe is that last night was a night of incredible activity, really all through the day and all through the evening, left with a classic ring, except instead of being around the sun, since so much of the activity took place at night, very, very heavy ring around the moon last night.
Are you in advance of one of the major weather fronts moving through that area then?
Right. Apparently, you know, the word is that there is a big front coming through. It hasn't rained today at all, so I don't know. California, I haven't been tracking the satellite maps. But
it's moving through California, so it's headed your way.
Right.
All right. Well, there we go. Okay. My guest, by the way, if you join us late, Clifford Carnicom, his website, a must stop, Carnicom, CARNICOM.com. And for all of you out there who are endeavoring and trying to convince people that something unusual and outrageous is going on above all of us, this is the website to take your friends to. If they can't come away after looking at the pictures and reading an article, an essay or two, a report or two, and figure it out, it's time to go on to someone else. Now, you've done your best. Okay, Clifford, go ahead.
Thank you, Jeff. The objective at this point is to seek, a rational explanation as to why this material would appear to have an electrically charged behavior.
Right. By the way, might I interject one other quick thing here? On the front page at carnicom.com, you'll see on the chemtrail page, right in the center, the little objects, the tiny particles that Clifford is talking about. There's a camera shot, again, aimed up with a roof overhang and the corona of the sun just peeking over the edge. And you'll see these little objects. They look like, for those of you who can't see it, little tiny thin white lines streaking hither and yon every direction imaginable. I can only tell you that this particular phenomenon, again, was pioneered by John Brough and others 7-8 years ago. And as you well know now, Clifford, up until 2 or 3 years ago, these roof shots, as we can call them, were essentially devoid of this kind of activity. I never saw anything like this before.
Absolutely. There is no record of this, and that's because it is a radical alteration of the Earth's atmosphere. Unfortunately, I'm afraid most people will not get upset at that which they cannot see easily or right in front of their faces. And this material has many interesting aspects in terms of the way it has been managed.
Yep.
And apparently is not visible, let's say, under normal lighting conditions. In fact, I mentioned that entity called a plasma frequency, which is still sort of interesting and related. But this material is transparent to us under normal lighting conditions. However, if their listener will make the effort to view this material under the very specific lighting conditions that are described on the site and through other researchers, which led to that documentation by film, I think it would be of interest to almost anyone, and hopefully more than interest, and hopefully of concern.
Indeed.
There is a video on the website that I've tried to put up there to capture some of the elements, although because of the resolution difficulties on the net, it's very limited. But it will give you some idea of the behavior of the material.
Right.
We are considering three elements here, and understand my consideration is not restricted to these three. These are just three that do have my interest for various reasons.
Mm-hmm.
We can say that one or more of the elements of group 1 and 2, the existence of one or more of these, is consistent with the observations that have been recorded. There is a special interest in barium, though, because of many combinations of properties which seem to be reasonable. But in terms of backing up to these three elements and concerning what amount of energy does it take and where could it come from to ionize material and possibly explain this erratic motion of the material. And the three elements being considered right now, for example's sake, would be barium, magnesium, and aluminum. And this is not a trivial problem. Actually, it's quite interesting. Einstein was behind this work in terms of understanding what it takes to separate electrons from a metal. And here's the results. Here's the finding. Barium is an element which can be ionized by the sunlight alone. Visible sunlight, the energy within the visible sunlight, is sufficient to ionize the element of barium. It's a very interesting finding, and there are a few other elements which will also qualify. But it definitely stands out, and it's let's just say it's reasonable again. It is possible. You do not need an external source of energy beyond the sun to ionize the element of barium.
Okay.
Magnesium would appear to be somewhat in between. It's right on the edge. It's a certain wavelength that will actually cause this to happen. With barium, it's 335 nanometers. That would be just slightly into the ultraviolet, called mid-range ultraviolet light. So I guess it would seem to me it's somewhat a borderline. It would be possible, but I don't know that it would be very heavily ionized the way barium would be easily ionized.
All right, we've got barium and magnesium. When we come back, we'll discuss aluminum and how it compares to its two predecessors in the string of three we're discussing with Clifford Carnicom, our premier online citizen researcher and scientist looking into this outrageous practice of spraying us with aerosolizations of something, and maybe more than something. Be right back in just a couple minutes.
Get back to the Jeff Rentz program on the Talk Radio Network.
And we're back talking with Clifford Carnicom about chemtrails and more reports coming in email-wise. Thank you, folks, for sending them in. Go ahead, Clifford. Aluminum, how does it differ from barium and that borderline magnesium element, which might or might not be ionized by solar radiation?
Thank you, Jeff. The reason that I have considered aluminum in this study is because many individuals have spoken of aluminum. We must consent to the fact that there are many statements that are made, but we don't necessarily have a strong or a solid foundation or a chain of evidence which is supportive of some of these claims over time. Aluminum may or may not be in that category, but I was just curious of this question: is it consistent with the observed behavior of the material?
Mm-hmm.
If you look at aluminum under this question of ionization, it is not ionizable by the visible portion of sunlight by any means. Aluminum is ionized in what is called the shortwave ultraviolet portion of the spectrum.
Okay.
And this type of energy is stopped by the ozone layer. That level and above, 289 nanometers is the number I come up with for the wavelength.
All right.
So that's significant in terms of if we're to propose an idea or a rationale for something, we have to be consistent across the board. And all I'm saying here is that consideration does need to be given on an elemental basis as to how much energy is required. Is it available, and is it consistent with what we see? And the results are that certain elements, those which are receiving the greatest attention, are consistent with the observations, and others are not. And so it's wise to put our energy and time into that subset of elements which is most reasonably in agreement with the observations. Also, bear in mind that there is supportive work in spectrometry that I have done that also collaborates with the barium findings. And, you know, if there's one thing that we're seeing from this work, it is that work needs to be done. The conclusion comes out over and over and over that there is a tremendous amount of serious professional work which needs to be done to satisfy the questions which have been raised by myself and many others, which are thus far not being answered adequately or legitimately by any formal source whatsoever. So this is basically the sort of a resting point which sets a foundation combined with our earlier discussions for a significant electromagnetic component to the aerosol operations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we won't have time to go over, and I don't think there's a need to necessarily go over. I hope folks can listen to the previous interviews also. But there is a very consistent pattern of evidence, information, research, deductions, analysis, which put forth the reasonable supposition that there is a very significant electromagnetic component to these operations, and the logical deductions which can be made, or let's say presumptions as to an intent or agenda, would involve the transmission of energy, is the best that I could assess it. The transmission of energy through a charged medium, namely an ionized atmosphere, would appear to be a reasonable postulate that satisfies the work thus far. So this is one major finding which I believe that we as citizens need to become involved in and find an accounting and accountability for the existence of this material in our atmosphere,
mm-hmm.
and its effect on both our environment and our health, and the reason for why it's there.
Any concept as to how long it might remain airborne? Is it showing signs of drifting out, settling out, or is it staying up there almost indefinitely because of its tiny size?
Well, I think there's a combination there. I mean, there's a question of whether or not you're at a main. You know, if a person develops a system that accomplishes a certain level of saturation.
Yeah, and what's the maintenance aspect?
Yeah, there's a certain maintenance level that's required. Mm-hmm. Actually, there are tables available that show the drift rates of particulate matter by size,
mm-hmm.
and it primarily would be a function of size. And the fact is you can predict how long it will take, and particulate matter in the sky, depending on size, can range anywhere from days to weeks to even years up in the sky.
Sure.
So a broad range is actually quite possible. And the size estimates of the material that's up there does appear to range at this very small level of either submicrons or several microns in size. So, you know, I think we're basically covering that gamut,
mm-hmm.
anywhere from days to weeks to months,
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
years.
Very smart. You know, Clifford, there are people listening to the program right now who know exactly what's going on.
Well, we
that
know
is sadly
that
humorous.
The program and system was developed, and unfortunately it was a decision was made that this operation will be kept secret from the American people. That's a decision that was made. Unfortunately, I have to disagree with that decision no matter what is at stake. There are also other human rights at stake, which are really are the foundation of our country's existence to begin with, which exist at levels even higher than national security. I'm sure there are some who would disagree with that.
Sure.
But that's certainly my opinion. If you lose certain basic human rights and foundations to govern civilization, you basically do not have civilization anymore.
What costs national security? If one person becomes seriously ill from this, is that acceptable? You can argue it. If one person becomes seriously ill and dies, if 10 people become seriously ill and die of pneumonia or other complications because their immune system is racked by whatever is being done, if 100 people, is that acceptable? These are all really important questions.
I think that, you know, most people believe in the defense of their way of life and their nation. And if
Well, we can start by trying to take control of our own borders before we worry about the rest of it, I think. But right. Go ahead. That's another story.
You know, and if one knows the reason as to why we make a claim or an effort to accomplish something, then people usually are willing to fight for it. There are many people that have given their lives to give us the country that we live in.
You bet.
And this is no different. There are certain rights that we as human beings have, and I believe that this is one of them, the right of informed consent. This dates goes back to, you know, if it wasn't an issue, then why were there congressional hearings held in 1977 on this very same issue?
Mm-hmm.
Very same issue
mm-hmm.
of informed consent of foreign operations by substance, I mean by materials,
right.
Upon the American public without their consent. It deserved the attention of the nation at that time. It deserves the attention of the nation at this time.
More so now, perhaps, than then. Who knows? All right. You've got more items on the list. We want to start, I guess, into the next one before we have to take our break, if you'd like.
Sure. I'd be glad to. Sort of resting on that first theme of electromagnetic energy and its potential application in a very general sense, there is another theme that is going to emerge. This was not my intent, and I will describe how it has come about. And it will involve a biological aspect to this operation. Let me explain a little bit of how this came about. If we accept that particulate matter is in the sky in the way that has been documented thus far and is available for all to see,
mm-hmm.
The obvious question comes up is, what is it and how do I get a hold of it? I want to look at it and I want to see it. So the need for filtration immediately comes up. And so you have to ask, how are you going to get this stuff? By all signs, this stuff is extremely small. Difficult problem. Can't see it. Can't get a hold of it easily, no matter what. EPA isn't showing anything. In fact, they're saying the particular counts are going down. They're not telling us anything that's going on, and yet we see it and know it's there.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the motivation to establish a method which conceivably would collect particulate matter out of the atmosphere, particulate matter of extremely small size. And size is a big issue here. Because really there is no telling right now what the actual size is. So I wanted a method for that, and so I started doing some research. And a very interesting method starts to show itself, and it's called electrostatic precipitation. And this is a method which has been in existence since the early 1900s. A fellow named Cottrell was apparently a major player in developing this for industry, because he had there was a desire to clean up the fog of London, I guess is where it started, and they had ideas of cleaning the atmosphere up on a grand scale. That type of accomplishment was never achieved. However, commercial level precipitators were developed for plants and factories and had very good success and has become a major method of removing particulate matter from the sky. And there's a fellow by the name of A.D. Moore that wrote a book called Electrostatics. It was out of print. It just came back into print. And I started taking a look at this book, and the fellow had a very interesting experiment in there, incredibly simple, but really quite fascinating to me. The setup is this. You take a glass container, fill it with smoke, tobacco smoke, any kind of smoke, paper smoke. Fill a glass jar with smoke, and if you were to have an electrode inserted, a wire inserted into that container through a plastic lid, and you were to have that electrode attached to a very high voltage source of energy, high voltage, low current, amazing things would happen. And that is that smoke would precipitate. It would actually layer itself on the inside of that glass jar, and it happens within seconds. It's an absolutely incredible event to witness.
So it would organize itself and separate itself in seconds.
That's right.
Huh. All right. Stand by. We'll take a break, come right back, and look into the science that Clifford Carnicom has applied to and the results he has extracted from his study of chemtrails, as they affect all of us in this country and others. Be right back.